This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not.
Subscriber time. Can I read a subscriber message? As we head into our 50th year of broadcasting, of which Published or Not has been on for about 25, your ongoing subscription is as vital to the station today as it was for those subscribing in 1976. But we have authors that weren't even born then. So we better start. Here we go.
Oh, well, there's changes too. Many magazines are losing their appeal, so a company has to be proactive in this social media world. Anne Penny doesn't write for magazines, but her main character in Capturing Love does. Welcome, Anne.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Josie Spencer is your character. What is her job at Maud Magazine?
So she is a photographer from Australia. And so primarily she's a photographer, but she's asked to do more and more. So she ends up writing articles as well for a segment called Capturing Love.
Capturing Love. Yeah. She's been in New York for 6 years and owns a stupendous apartment. So what's her story?
So her parents passed away 6 years beforehand, and obviously she inherited money, but she didn't want to live sort of off that money. She wanted to sort of prove herself, even though her parents, you know, aren't alive anymore. So she spent it all on this fabulous apartment, but then she had to go out and get a job and pay all the bills and do everything else. So it's sort of her way of proving to the world she can be capable, yeah.
And there's Pete.
The boyfriend, or
Lucy, that is not a girl.
No, Lucifer is the dog.
A gentle giant astray. I thought he was a fully grown dog, but he was a puppy and kept on growing, and named Lucifer because of his ability to destroy things.
Yes.
Especially eating shoes.
Yeah, lived experience in my world.
Josie's, well, she's very well known for her ability to exit without saying goodbye from a pub, a club, or even a bed. She's so keen on saving that she hasn't travelled much, or even around America, and the ability to travel to Europe is years away. The story starts with her on a job with travel paid to a destination. So where's she going and what's she doing?
So, yeah, she gets a paid gig to Las Vegas to cover a hen's night or bachelorette party, I guess they call them over there, of a big-time socialite. You know, she wants it all recorded. So she's there to take all the photos of that.
Josie's written her own list of six things she'd like to do in Las Vegas. So she's taking photos at a hen's night for a bride, Melanie Warren. But when she is taking the photos, what does she notice about Melanie?
Yeah, so Josie has this knack of seeing a lot of emotion through eyes, and just she just found as she asks questions, there's just that sort of lack of sort of love there. Yeah.
So, well, she leaves the hen's night when it's getting a little bit...
getting a bit dodgy.
Yeah. And one of the things on her list of things to do is to go to the Bellagio fountain.
Yes,
no, I haven't seen this, so you better tell me, well, what does it do?
Oh, it's a big, it's part of a casino there. It's got this massive fountain and it's all sort of lit up and all to music, and it's really beautiful.
And she's taking photos. As I scanned through the bodies pressed up against the barrier, I paused on a man, not much older than myself. He leant over the railing, vacantly staring at the dancing water. Snap. His eyes were glazed and he appeared lost in thought. Snap. He ran his hand through his scruffy brown hair and breathed a heavy sigh. His shoulders relaxed, but his face remained laced with tension. Snap. I zoomed in a little closer, hoping to catch a glimpse of his eyes. Eye colour had always fascinated me, and I wondered which particular shade he was blessed with. Moving up his well-built body, I paused on his flawless face. Snap, snap. My heart quickened as I examined his defined jawline, tempting lips and sparkling eyes. Eyes that were looking directly at me.
Oh, gosh, I feel the embarrassment.
So who was that?
So that is Grayson. So he is, yeah, the other main character in the story. And then we get to know more about him soon.
So he helps Joseph realize the other things on the list of stuff that she wants
to do. So he somehow, you'll find out later, has all these contacts in Las Vegas, and he's able to pull strings and get to the top of queues and everything just for her to complete this list, which is very lovely.
They both have relationships in their real world. And what does Pete surprise Josie with when she returns to New York?
Oh, yeah, that's a doozy. She's not sort of the very romantic type, but she comes home to a very romantic setup.
Rose petals,
yes.
Up to the bed.
Yes.
Pete on his knee.
Yep.
It doesn't end happily.
No.
Back at
it's
work.
Very awkward.
She is horrified to learn that all her photos that she took writing up the hen's night for her Capturing Love column have come to nothing. And even worse, she may be losing her job. So what's happening with the Maud magazine?
So, for some reason, this wedding is called off. I don't know if I'm allowed to say why. The lady that was getting married.
They're dumped.
Maybe somehow related to.
And the magazine.
Person.
New owners.
Yes, new owners. I wonder
the
who that could
Harlow
be.
Harlow Company.
Yes.
There's Adam and William, who goes by the name Grayson.
Yes. Yeah.
And Adam, the older brother, has a rule, no relationships between employees. However, Grayson and Josie secretly move around those with some very hot sex. But Grayson also has a life back in LA with his parents and Melanie. And while he is there, what does Adam do?
Oh, he's very much the womanizer, and you'll get to know him pretty well throughout the series. But he's trying. He's
hardest with.
He'll try
break that rule about employees.
He's got no idea.
Moves in on Josie.
Yeah. No idea what his brother's up to. But
in LA, Melanie posts about Grayson and their relationship makeup, and her engagement is on again. Yeah. You'll have to read to find out what the family could threaten Grayson with to make this happen. But Josie doesn't have any family, but she does have Lenny. And when Lenny meets Grayson, Lenny also threatens Grayson.
Yes. Yeah, he's the typical New Jersey, pretends to have mafia connections. whispers a few little things in his ear.
Before all of this happens, Grayson wants Josie to meet the family at Christmas. I love how sentimental she was with the gifts that she chose for the family. And there was a reminder of Las Vegas to Grayson. What did she give him?
Oh, my gosh. Was it
penis candy.
Yeah, in a slot machine cookie jar or something, I think. Yeah. Okay.
Look, there were lots of laughs in this book. You know, PJs till noon and some very embarrassing moments for Josie, particularly as she was not keen on answering a phone. However, the weekend, this Christmas weekend, was not a success, and worse, Melanie comes to New York after this and has particular skills, and she offers to help Josie.
Yes. Yeah, she has a lot of connections in her socialite world and finds out Josie's a beautiful photographer and wants to really help her put on an exhibition. Yeah, so there's a lot of, I guess, there.
They get drunk together watching and laughing through a romantic comedy, and Josie likes her.
Yes.
And Melanie tells her a truth, but it's not up to Josie to tell. Melanie looks as if she has a perfect life, and if you looked at a social media post, you'd think so.
Yes, very curated and beautiful, yes.
This is another quote from the book. This is Josie talking. I wouldn't worry about her social media. That's how she wants everyone to see her. I guess it gives her some semblance of control, since it's only thing in her life her parents have no say in. Her reality is a lot darker. I narrowed my gaze. So, not only is she striving for her parents' approval, she's also searching for validation from strangers. Sounds healthy? No, she's got a few problems, that Melanie. You write about grief, loss and healing.
Yes.
And Josie being so alone in this book too.
Yeah.
The surprise at the epilogue. Who finally gets a voice there?
Oh, Grayson. Well, yeah, yeah, the whole book is written in her point of view until the last chapter, yeah.
Yeah. Last word to Josie's photographic skills, and this is page 68. I've always been an observer, picking up on subtle clues. It's not always about a person's smile or their tears. It's everything leading up to them. The glistening eyes, the trembling lip, the clenched jaw, they all show something deeper. That is where the beauty lies. Which leads us very succinctly on to Capturing Love is a whole series of books. There's Capturing Love, there's Finding Beauty and Saving a Soul. So, Anne Penny, tell me, had you written all of these books before you got the contract?
Yeah, they were all written, and I actually only intended this to be a standalone as I was writing. Oh, actually, I sent it to my editor, and I actually made Melanie to be horrible, and she said, no one's that mean, and then suddenly my head's just given her a whole book. I then had to write that, and then everyone's like, well, what about Adam? Like, he's so, you know, interesting, and I'm like, all right, he gets a book too. So it was all written before Arndell got it.
You can't help yourself, can you? Because there's a little bit at the book here that has a co-worker, Amy, and her little relationship with Reed downstairs.
Yes.
Okay. An Australian photographer in New York meets a wealthy businessman from LA who has a controlling family and an insistent fiancé. Will the necessities of life drive them apart? Capturing Love is the first in a romantic series by Anne Penny. Thank you, Anne.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jan. Now, we're diverging a little here, and it's time for a subscriber message with a difference, because 3CR's community, and we're talking about another community that is artificial, whereas 3CR would sort of have a very real community out there, so do subscribe. But my divergence is into a work that provides us with an insight into the digital world and the challenges faced by young people and parents alike. The author is Dr. Niraj Lal, and the book is entitled Behind the Screens. So, Nij, welcome to 3CR.
Morning, David. Thanks for having me.
The chances are you are the product. Now, this is a line from the book. The internet seems to have flipped the status quo here. We're both the consumer and the consumed. Explain.
That's right. I mean, it's one of the most transformative technologies of our time, really, and the internet and all the digital things that we can do on it. And what's astonishing is that a lot of it is free. You can go online and search anything, you can read Wikipedia, you can go on your socials, and you don't pay for it with money. But the chances are, if something is free, very often you are the product.
Well, this is a deception. How are you the product, though?
Well, in a bunch of different ways. You are being shown things on the internet that aren't always your choice. You're being shown ads. You've been shown different things that will pop up in your feed. And those are monetized. People pay. Advertisers and companies pay platforms to show that product to you, and it's remarkable. I don't know if some of your listeners might know about it. Google Ads is probably it's the most lucrative way to advertise on the internet. Most companies do it. You pay them, and you say, "I'll pay you like somewhere between like $1 and $2 per 1,000 impressions is about the rate, and then $1 to $50, maybe sometimes more, per click through." And you say, Google, I've got like this much I want to spend in this month. And they're like, okay, we'll go and do it. And we'll put it in front of the people who are most likely to click through, because that's how they make their money. And they're really good at it. And they show us stuff that we want to look at. And that's how it works.
But we're actively giving ourselves over to the internet. These companies are collecting meta data about us. So we are being compromised, or
so here's the trick. So for Google to make the most money they can for people to click through and for people to want to advertise with Google, I mean, it's sort of the same for a bunch of other advertising companies. They have to show it to the person who is going to be the people who are going to most likely click on it, who are interested in it. And how do they know that? How do they find that out? Well, it's because they have an incredibly detailed profile of pretty much everyone that uses the internet. It's like they know us almost better than we know ourselves.
But we're voluntarily giving them this information.
So that profile is built up through all of our interactions on the net. They are, like most of them, are tracked to an incredible degree. What we see, what sites we visit, how long we stay or hover across a certain pixel. It's all being tracked in the background to provide not only information about you, but information about anyone that might be like you, someone who's interested in the community and books or whatever it might be that your profile would be.
And physiologically, we're like rats in a cage wanting the next dopamine fix.
That's true. I mean, that's the way, it's one way to keep people engaged on the internet. That's what's called the attention economy. If you're engaged and you're on a platform, if you're on a thing, you're scrolling, the more time you spend, the more time you are looking past ads and the more ways they get paid. And the reason, or that they've figured out a way to do it, to kind of hijack into our brains. And our brains are so soft, they're so susceptible. We have an almost infinite capacity for being liked or being affirmed or validated by the people that we love or being entertained. And the best programmers in the world have kind of found a way to check into that, to plug into that part of our brains, to keep showing us those little bits of likes or little dings or hearts or thumbs ups that we love, that kind of evolved out of our chimpanzee brains on the African savannah and people picking lice out of us. We love it, and they use those desires within us to keep us scrolling, to see more ads, to get paid.
So we are very susceptible. Now, I've got another concern here, because not just sort of physiologically, but our intelligence, our intellect, the way we think, I believe, is being actually altered or changed.
Yeah, there's some lovely books that have been written about this for some time now. The Shallows early on by Nicholas Carr, and Stolen Focus, Yohan Hari. They really are changing how we think. Even the act of reading something online versus a printed page in a book, the act of going past a hyperlink, your brain is making the decision, oh, do I click on that hyperlink or do I not? Oh, where's the reference for that? The nature of our engagement becomes shallower over time. And we're seeing that with film, with TV, with online content. The length of time of a cut is drastically reducing. Now it's like such quick cut stuff that we see. Yeah. If you look back at an old film, you're like, wow, it's really slow. Like, things aren't really happening. And the same thing that's happening in our brains and our ability to think and think deeply. I mean, maybe we're seeing more content. Maybe we're being entertained in different ways. But we are certainly being changed by the mediums that we're on the internet with. And one of the lovely sayings is that the medium is the message, and it's true. Yeah. It's becoming the message.
But also then, psychologically, I mean, we are susceptible. We want society. We want gratification. We want to be liked. So, you know, that like button or whatever. So it's getting into our feelings and basically manipulating those as well.
That's right. And they're pretty good. I mean, there's a lovely saying, I mean, we shouldn't be too hard on ourselves. You know, don't feel too badly. There's a saying that, you know, every time you put your phone down, there's thousands of the world's best paid engineers trying to make you pick it back up again. And they're really good at it, actually. They're well paid and they're good at their job and they make them bloody engaging. And so, the reason behind the book is to say, well, maybe if we could tell young people about that, give them some info and some tools about it, then maybe they'll be able to make some better decisions than certainly we do.
Well, this begs the next question in terms of who is morally and ethically responsible. Now, we've had the Australian government, the first country in the world to do it, to put in legislation about 16-year-olds and such like. There are other countries that follow. But how culpable, how responsible, how ethically and morally susceptible or responsible are those companies that are actually making money of it? Is it the government responsibility? Is it a parent responsibility? Who? What?
That's a good question. I mean, I think all of the above, though. But I think I actually blame companies the least. I mean, I think everyone should have a moral responsibility. But in some sense, they're in some ways, this is going off tangent, right? But corporations are in some sense moral psychopaths. They aren't required to think about anything morally. They have, certainly public companies, they have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders to maximise profits within the bounds of what the laws are. And that includes advocating to change the laws so that they can make their own profits. And I mean, not to say all companies are evil, but I think we should consider them as such within our legal framework. Say they're going to try to make as much money as they can. That's their role and that's how they do it. I think it's on us to be aware of that and to governments to play the catch-up game of regulation, for sure.
But if we are psychologically susceptible and such like, then can we actually do it? I mean, can a parent tell their child, no, turn it off, because the child's going to complain? So psychologically, yeah. Physiologically... we are basically programmed by nature to do that.
Yeah, I think we are. I think it's tricky. I mean, it's tricky to always work in our best interests or in our long-term interests, and it's hard to, certainly as a parent, you know, it's tricky to have those conversations with young people. I think we can do it. I think there are ways to go about it. You know, there's like, you know, one of the earliest things you teach a kid is like delayed gratification. You know, you can't have the thing now. You just got to wait a little while. And it's the same for all of us through time, and I think it's on us to help have that conversation, to raise our young ones to be aware and be equipped of it. And then also, I mean, wonderful that there's action on the other end. I spoke with Julie, the Australia's eSafety Commissioner. Wonderful, really courageous, their advocacy in this space, and it's been taken up around the world. Spain, France, UK is considering now similar things.
But this blowback from the companies.
As there would be, and as there naturally should be, because they have to act in the interests of their shareholders to maximise their profits. And we shouldn't expect anything different. I don't think we should expect companies to be moral in this space. I mean, like, I would hope that they could be, and there's a bunch of them are, and B corporations, wonderful. But public companies for profit, I wouldn't expect any different.
I'm feeling a little naive here, yeah. Because without that cooperation, we're lost, I would argue.
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, I spoke to the YouTube's head of safety and machine learning about it. And, you know, they, like, you know, it's probably a bit unfair to characterize them as psychopaths. That's not always the case. But, you know, they are doing things to ensure the safety of their users and people on the internet, but only to the point at which it affects their ability to make money. That's my interpretation.
But the nature of how the digital world works, algorithms, I mean, it's automatically a bot is curating what we see because we hit on it because we want another fix. That's our interest. And so it leads us down a rabbit hole. And this is where you get QAnon and sovereign citizens. Certainly, and yeah. Things like that. Yep. So if it's a thing, so this is not the company, this is now the program that's leading us, which has no responsibility whatsoever.
Certainly right. And we talk about it a bit in the book, what an algorithm is and how they're made. And I mean, an algorithm at its bare bones is just a set of instructions, like, you know, a recipe for baking a cake is an algorithm in some sense. But the algorithms to keep us engaged online, to show us what next thing in our feed, made of thousands of lines of code, and they're really good, and they really know us. You know, like the stuff we see, the stuff we're suggested, Spotify, YouTube, whatever it might be, like, actually, that's pretty good. But it can lead us very quickly into very different directions. And we talk about that too, misinformation, disinformation, echo chambers, rabbit holes. What do you do? How do you know if you're in one?
It's hard. Then, I mean, you've also got AI in here. If we concede to AI, who is now writing the algorithm, which has no moral base whatever, you know, are we completely lost? I mean, are we playing catch-up? Where do we stand?
I think it's tricky. It's a different age that we're moving in. Code now is being written by AI, by code. And there, you know, there are machine learning kind of algorithms that play them against each other that make them so good. It's why deepfakes are now incredible, indistinguishable to the untrained eye, even to the trained eye. They're getting better at predicting what we want to see and how to keep us engaged. And it's on us to take the next step, to be like, how do we act in our best interests? How do we ensure that our kids spend some time outside or are less hooked? And it's tricky because we're hooked. So what do we do?
But we're hooked and we are gullible and easily deceived. So how would we know anyway?
It's true. It's one of the things we talk about in the book. How do you know what to believe on online or anywhere? It's tough. I mean, I think you can do it. There are answers. That's one of the things I host a podcast for the ABC, Imagine This, and it's a science podcast. And one of the things we try to do is to say, well, there's things you can learn about the world. There are facts and truths out there that you can observe for yourself and justify for yourself. And it's giving young people that capability to figure things out for themselves and decide what is true and understand what is believable and what is not that we should do.
Well, what they need more of are books like this, because this is actually a guide for 12 to 15, 16?
No, a bit younger. Before kids get their phone, I figured, if we could give them that before they get their devices for the first time, then hopefully we can do well. So 9 to 12 to 13,
that's right. But also, I'd say it's mandatory reading for adults and parents as well, because really the onus, as you say, is on us. So to understand, there were things in here I didn't know about. I've got a vague overview, etc., but I still work an analog board here at 3CR.
That's great. Hold the line.
Hold the line.
Not today, AI. Yeah.
And 3CR is a real active people-based community. There's my subscriber pitch again. Whereas you've got the artificial world of the internet and where you go from there. So it's probably important reading, and the more books like this that we do have are vital. I mean, Jan, you're going to face this with your grandkids.
Don't worry. I'm going to buy this book and give it to my son before he actually gets those kids up to that age.
Yeah.
It's a good idea.
And buying a phone. When are they going to be given their first phone? These are questions parents are going to actually have to ask now. But for a whole generation, it's almost too late. Those questions have gone by the by.
But I'm also going to tell my granddaughter, just be careful of falling in love. So I spoke with Anne Penny about her romance comedy, Capturing Love.
And I was speaking with Dr. Niraj Lal, the book Behind the Screens, and that was a University of Queensland Press release. So Niraj, and thank you very much for coming in today. Real life people. We weren't talking with the internet. We're spontaneous.
We're not AI.
We passed the Turing test. And we will head out for another week and be back live next week. And so we're coming into... You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.